Okay, yeah. So I'll be talking about some work that I've been doing with the South Pole Telescope collaboration. So we've been trying to use dusty galaxies found in the CMB to probe the small scale, what's a small scale structure in cosmology. I should say that actually most of the work I'll be talking about really has been done by a student, Yashar Hezeveh, at McGill, who's just like fantastic. And this fall, Yashar will be moving on to Stanford. He's just amazing though, in terms of like productivity. So the context for this problem here is of course our standard model of cosmology, the Lambda CDM model. This model has of course proven just incredibly successful, like in matching a wide array of different types of observables. And it does so using only incredibly simple physics. So this model is characterized by just a small handful of parameters. Okay, so things like the matter density, the spectral index, this is not working, okay. And most of our knowledge of these parameters really comes from observations of the universe on very large scales. So of course the best example of this, of course, is the cosmic microwave background power spectrum. So Planck announced just amazing measurements this past year. But besides the CMB, of course, there are also other large-scale probes of cosmology that have also proven incredibly useful, such as, for example, measurements of the expansion history of the universe coming from type 1a supernovae, or from the measurements of the BAO feature as a function of redshift. Okay, so large-scale structure has just proven incredibly useful for cosmology. But today, I'll be arguing to you that small-scale structure is also going to be really useful moving ahead to the future. Okay, there's lots that we can learn by measuring small-scale structure in combination with previous existing measurements of large-scale structure. Okay, so it's possible to learn things about the shape of the potential of the inflaton field. It's possible to learn things about the particle physics properties of dark matter just by measuring the amount of the primordial power spectrum on very, very small scales. Now currently, to date, the best probe that we have of the small scale power spectrum comes from the Lyman Alpha forest. Okay. However, in the future though, it'll prove to be hard to use Lyman Alpha forest to improve our measurements of the small scale power spectrum, just simply because current existing high resolution forest spectrum already are pushing up against the gene scale of the gas in the IGM at redshifts of 2 to 3, okay. So in the future, to make improvements in our knowledge of the small scale power spectrum, I'll have to find some other probe besides just Lyman Alpha forest. Okay, so then what other probes are there to probe the power spectrum? One of the most famous probes, of course, just is counting objects. So for example, so it's very, very well known, for example, that the abundance of galaxy clusters probes the normalization of the power spectrum sigma 8, right? Now, more precisely, of course, the cluster abundance really is probing the power spectrum on certain scale. It's probing the power spectrum on scales of k of order 0.1 inverse megaparsecs. Very similarly, lower mass objects probe the power spectrum on smaller scales. Okay, so objects of mass m, roughly speaking, probe the fluctuations on length scales r proportional to m to the 1/3. Okay, so for example, the abundance of objects of mass 10 to the 8 solar masses, is probing fluctuations on scales of k around 10 or 100 or so. Okay, and so by mapping out the abundance of objects as a function of mass, we can thereby map out the shape of the power spectrum as a function of scale. Okay. So that statement is true for objects like dark matter halos. It's also equally true for objects like dark matter subhalos. Okay. So most of you are hopefully familiar with the fact, with the fact that dark matter halos are expected to contain lots and lots of dark matter substructure inside of them. Substructure in the form of gravitationally bound subhalos orbiting inside of larger structures. Okay. So these subhalos started out their lives as it's just like ordinary halos in their own right, but they just happen to fall into larger structures, okay? And so in the same way that these dark matter halos probe the abundance of the halos probes the power spectrum, quite similarly, the abundance of these sort of low-mass subhalos also is sensitive to the shape of the matter power spectrum on small scales, okay? And so, for example, so it's hoped that we can constrain things like the warm dark matter temperature, okay, just through observations of the amount of small scale substructure that exists inside of ordinary halos like the Milky Way. Okay, so that's the hope. Okay, so our goal, therefore, is to try to measure the abundance of these sort of low-mass halos and subhalos. Now, the most obvious way to measure their abundance just simply is to count galaxies, okay? So if we assume that every halo or subhalo has a galaxy inside of it, okay, then measurements of the abundance of those galaxies then tells us the abundance of the corresponding halos and subhalos. Okay, so if we try that exercise, the result is shown over here in these plots. Okay, so here I'm plotting the number, the mass function, basically. Okay, the number of like satellite subhalos as a function of velocity, which is basically this velocity is basically just like a mass proxy. Okay, so these black curves illustrate the predictions made from n-body simulations of of halos like the Milky Way taken from a cosmology similar to our standard W map, like Lambda CDM cosmology. And the vertical range here is meant to illustrate the typical scatter from halo to halo in this mass. Now, for comparison, these pink points with error bars show the actual measured number of, the actual measured number of luminous satellite galaxies around the Milky Way. And the key point to take away just is that we have an enormous discrepancy, especially at the smallest masses. Okay, so this huge discrepancy is, of course, called the famous missing satellites problem. And that problem has been around for the past 15, 20 years or so in cosmology. And some people have argued that perhaps this missing satellite problem might be evidence pointing towards modifications to the physics of dark matter, or perhaps modifications to the shape of the primordial power spectrum. Okay. But it's also, however, equally likely that the origin of this missing satellites problem might have nothing to do with particle physics, but instead, it might just be caused by, just by astrophysics. Okay. So the reasoning here is that the potential wells of these little tiny subhalos are very shallow, therefore making it extremely easy to eject gas out of those small objects. Okay. And so lots and lots of astrophysical mechanisms have been proposed to suppress the efficiency for forming stars in these sort of low-mass objects. Okay, so it's therefore possible that all of these predicted dark matter subhalos might actually be present inside of halos like the Milky Way, but just that most of them happen to be dark without any stars in them. And if that's true, then we can't use the counts of these luminous satellites to measure the abundance of these sort of dark matter halos and thereby constrain the power spectrum. Okay. So because it's possible for lots of these objects to exist but to be dark, what we need therefore is a probe that's sensitive to counting totally dark objects. And the only way to detect completely dark objects, of course, is to look for their gravitational effects. Okay, so therefore what we need is a gravitational probe of these sort of dark matter objects, dark matter halos and subhalos. And so in my talk, the gravitational probe that I'll focus on is called gravitational lensing. Okay, so lensing, of course, just refers to the deflection of light that's caused by density fluctuations in the universe. The most famous example, of course, of lensing just is the deflection of light around the sun, predicted by Einstein like a century ago and then verified by Eddington a few years later. Now, besides deflecting the locations of sources on the sky, lensing can also distort their appearances on the sky. Okay, and this bottom example illustrates that. Okay, so what's being shown here in this animation is lensing being caused by this foreground pink mass distribution, and in the background, a regular grid of blue circles is just marching to the left. Okay. Now the amount of lensing is usually characterized by a quantity that's called the convergence kappa, and this convergence is basically just the column density expressed in certain units. And there are two basic regimes of lensing, the weak lensing regime and the strong lensing regime. The weak lensing regime occurs when this column density is small compared to one, and for sources that are in the weak lensing regime, far away from any large masses, the effects of lensing are, of course, quite weak. All that happens just is that you get a small distortion in the shapes and sizes of the background sources. The other regime, though, is called strong lensing, and that occurs when this, That occurs when this column density is large, okay? And in strong lensing, as you can see, we often get enormous distortions in the shapes and sizes of the background sources of light. Strong lensing is also typically associated with having multiple imaging of the background sources. And so what that means is that the exact same object, So it means that the exact same object in the universe will appear in multiple places on the sky simultaneously. Okay, so that's strong lensing. All right. Now, because lensing is a function of mass and not light, you might therefore think that this sort of lensing might be a fantastic way to look for these sort of potentially completely dark halos and subhalos. However, though, in practice, it turns out to be extremely difficult to use lensing to detect these low-mass objects. And the reason just simply is that these low-mass halos and subhalos turn out to be these really terrible, terrible lenses. And there's two basic reasons for this. So first of all, so because these objects have low mass, they also have a small physical size, okay? And so therefore, they only cover a small fraction of the sky. Secondly, and more importantly, the lensing amplitudes of these low-mass objects are just generically really, really weak, okay? So in terms of that convergence number I mentioned before, the central convergence of these objects is typically quite small, values of like 0.1 or so, And so the problem then that we have is that these low-mass halos and subhalos act as weak lenses. They're all really tiny, And they're also just completely dark, which means that we have no idea where to look for them on the sky, okay? And so therefore, so to have any hope of detecting these objects using lensing, what we need, therefore, is a way to boost the lensing signal coming from these low-mass halos and subhalos, all right? And the way that we can boost the lensing signal from these low-mass objects is to use strong gravitational lensing, okay? So strong lenses are, of course, quite useful in astronomy. So we often use strong lenses to magnify the light coming from distant high redshift galaxies. Okay, but strong lenses can also act to magnify the lensing effect of other stuff that happens to be falling near them. Okay, and so for example, so if we place a low-mass halo or subhalo next to a bigger, more powerful strong lens, okay, then the lensing effect of that low-mass object gets boosted or amplified by precisely the lensing magnification factor coming from the bigger, more powerful, strong lens. And so if we therefore study the vicinities of massive, powerful, strong lenses, we therefore get enhanced sensitivity to the presence or absence of these sort of low-mass halos and subhalos. All right. Now, it turns out that strong lensing also provides a very characteristic signature for the effects of these sort of low-mass perturbations. And so let me show you how that works in practice. Okay, so suppose that we have some multiply imaged lens system. Sort of like this. And suppose that we have two of the images that happen to fall together very close together on the sky. Now, in this context, close together just simply means that the splitting on the sky is small compared to the overall size of the system. All right. Now, for cases like this, you can show very, very straightforwardly, that the brightnesses of these two images are expected to be very nearly equal to each other. Okay. So more precisely, the statement is that the fractional difference in the flux or brightness between those two images must be something like they're splitting on the sky divided by some local scale length in the gravitational potential, all right? Now, as long as the mass distribution around this lensing structure is smooth, then this local scale length in the potential necessarily will be something of order the size of the system, okay? And so therefore, for these sort of close pairs of images whose splitting is small compared to the size of the system, generically, this ratio will be small, and so therefore, this ratio will be small, and so therefore, those two images must have nearly equal brightnesses. Okay? So that's the prediction. There's a very similar relation that holds true if you have close triples of images, okay? So if you have three images falling very close together on the sky, the prediction just simply is that the middle image will have a brightness equaling the sum of the brightnesses of the two images next to it. Okay. And once again, the departure from that relation scale, something like the image splitting on the sky divided by some local scaling from the potential. right? And so as long as the mass distributions in these lensing objects are fairly smooth without small-scale structure in them, both of these relations must hold quite precisely. That's a generic prediction. Okay, so that was the prediction. Now, if we verify that prediction in actual systems, what we find is that it's almost always violated enormously. Okay, and that's illustrated here. So here I'm showing you two examples of some lensing systems. The left panel has two images falling very close together, A and B images. Okay, so the prediction is that A and B should have nearly equal brightnesses, whereas actually what we find is that A is twice as bright as B. Another example is shown here. This is a close triple of images. Okay, the prediction is that the middle image B should have a brightness equaling the sum of A and C, whereas in contrast, what you can see is that by far B is the faintest out of these three. And so what this says is that, therefore, this local scale length in the potential in both of these systems is not of order the size of the system, but instead something much, much smaller. Okay, that local scale length must be of order this image splitting or even smaller. Or in other words, both of these systems have small scale structure in their mass distributions. Okay, just quite clearly. So the presence of these sort of anomalous flux ratios, what this tells us is that the lensing potentials in these systems necessarily contain lots of small-scale structure inside of them, lots of substructure. Okay, and because these sort of flux ratio anomalies occur just so ubiquitously among these lenses, what it says is that generically all halos have lots and lots of substructure inside of them. Okay. So about 10 years ago, we analyzed a huge sample of all of the known radio lensing systems. Okay, so it was a sample of seven objects. Okay, and so based on our analysis of those seven objects, what we found was that a large fraction of the mass in these objects had to be in the form of substructure. Okay, so quantitatively, our result was that something like 1 or 2% of the mass at 5 kiloparsecs radius had to be in the form of gravitationally self-bound substructure. However, the error bar on our measurement was enormous, okay? And the reason why the error bar was enormous, of course, just was simply, The reason just was that the size of our sample was so tiny, okay? And so therefore, to make improvements, to this measurement, what's needed, therefore, is a larger sample. Unfortunately, however, this sample consisted of all of the known, quasar lenses at the time. Okay, and so therefore, to make further progress in this area, what's needed is a new class of lensed sources. And fortunately, of course, there is such a new class of lensed sources, which is why I'm here talking to you right now. Oh yeah, go ahead, Latham. Can you say that again? So the idea is that the substructure has to be... Right. Yeah, so if it's far away, it'll affect both the images the same way. Right. Yeah, that's right. The scale length corresponding to that substructure has to be of order or smaller than the splitting of the images, which requires, I think, that that its distance has to be that size or even smaller. That's right. Oh, yeah, so these are typically in regions without any baryons. So most of these lens systems fall at like several effective radii. The effective radius of a galaxy is something like its half mass radius. And so at its several effective radii, you are totally dark matter dominated. That's right. Oh, yeah, either. That's right. So lensing is, of course, just sensitive only to projected two-dimensional mass distributions, right? Yeah, so in principle, we have very little handle on the line of sight locations of these objects. Okay, yeah, I know. But for the purposes of cosmology, of course, we don't really care where they are. All that we care just is the abundance of these low-mass objects. Yeah. Any other questions about that before I go on? So here is an image of the new class of lens sources I was talking about. So here I'm showing you some data from the South Pole Telescope Survey, SPT. So most of the structure that you see in this image is actual real structure. So most of these wiggles just correspond to primary CMB anisotropies. You can also see some other structure, though, in this map. So for example, over here is a massive galaxy cluster producing a whopping SZ decrement. But instead, however, I'll be focusing on these bright emissive submillimeter sources. So some of those sources turn out to be interesting because it turns out that some of them happen to be extremely bright, dusty, star-forming galaxies. Now, for this audience, perhaps these galaxies aren't intrinsically very interesting. So for this audience, just the main point is that these galaxies happen to be incredibly luminous, incredibly bright. They have luminosities of like hundreds of thousands of times more than the Milky Way at the same kind of stellar mass. And surveys like SPT and Herschel are, these surveys are now finding large numbers of these sort of extremely bright, dusty galaxies. So SPT is seeing lots of these dusty galaxies. So why is that interesting? Who cares? The reason why those galaxies are interesting is because it turns out that basically all of them are strongly lensed. And the reason for that is shown here on this plot. So here I'm showing you the number of these galaxies as a function of their flux or their brightness. So these points correspond to the measured luminosity function. And for a comparison, this black, this red curve shows the intrinsic luminosity function of these galaxies. And the key point just to notice is that at the bright end, the intrinsic luminosity function falls off exponentially quickly like a Schechter function. Now, in contrast, the probability for lensing magnification falls off, so it falls off much, much less quickly at the bright end. So probability for magnification falls off, sort of like a power law at the bright end. And so therefore, at the bright end, you are always dominated by lensing magnification. So a bright galaxy seen out here is always much, much more likely to be intrinsically much fainter and just magnified by some large factor. So that's the prediction. So the prediction is that basically all of these bright galaxies are all strongly lensed. And of course, that prediction is verified. So here I'm showing you some of the early ALMA imaging obtained for some of these bright SPT sources. So the red contours show the ALMA flux. These are all just taken from little two-minute snapshots. And for comparison, the grayscale shows, it shows some near-IR imaging taken, taken usually at HST, but in some cases also at VLT. But the key point here, though, just is that So in all the cases, the submillimeter flux gets broken up into multiple images, multiple components, And sitting between all those components, we always find a massive foreground low redshift galaxy, And so therefore, quite clearly, all these systems are indeed strong lenses as expected, And so here are some more examples of that, So overall, in total, currently, we have something like 50 of these lenses. And in total, from the whole survey, we expect something like 100 in total from SPT. We've also started modeling the mass distributions in these systems. And the key point I want to just sort of highlight is that the magnification factors that we're finding just generically are quite large. So typically we're getting magnification factors of like 10 or 20 or so. And that's good because, as we saw before, the higher the magnification, the more sensitive these objects will be to the presence of small-scale perturbations. So we have lots and lots of these sort of lens submillimeter galaxies. But why is that interesting? Why should we care? This is interesting to us just because these galaxies turn out to be almost perfect sources for studying dark matter substructure. And the reason is that these sources, the emission from these sources, is expected to be dominated by a handful of some very, very compact star-forming clumps. And so one example of that is shown here. So here I'm showing you some very high-resolution imaging taken at the SMA array for a lens submillimeter galaxy. And so you can see that at high resolution, the source galaxy gets broken up into multiple compact components, you can also see a possible flux ratio anomaly in this system, Okay, yeah, no. So for example, the A and B images on this side do not have the same brightness as A and B images on this side. Okay, possibly already indicating something interesting going on in the mass distribution here. Okay. All right, now I mentioned that these sources are useful because they have compact clumps in them. And the reason why the compactness is important is illustrated here. All right. So here what I'm showing you are two identical simulations, lensing simulations, okay? But in the right-hand example, what was done was to place a small dark matter substructure perturbation next to one of the lensed images, all right? And this left panel will show the ratio of the perturbed brightness divided by the unperturbed brightness, okay? And so now what I'll do is to slowly shrink the size of the background source galaxy that's being lensed. All right. And so if I do so, shrinking the size of the source, as you'll see, will have the effect of enhancing the effect of that small dark matter perturber sitting next to one of the images. Okay. And so the more compact the background source is, the more sensitive it'll be to the effects of this sort of small scale substructure in the mass distribution. Now I also mentioned ALMA. And the reason why ALMA helps us here is that ALMA provides spatially resolved spectroscopy. Okay. And so to see why that helps, so let's just go through a simple example. All right. So suppose that we have some galaxy that's being observed with some very, very single broadband channel. Okay. So in that one single channel, that whole galaxy looks like some big extended blob. All right. Now, if we instead, however, observe the exact same galaxy using many, many narrow frequency channels, okay, then that same galaxy, looks quite different, okay? Because the reason is that the various components in that galaxy show up separately in the separate frequency channels. Why is that happening? That's happening because the various components in this galaxy are moving relative to each other at some large velocity, okay? And those velocities generate Doppler shifts. Okay? And so when observed in these multiple narrow channels, the size of this galaxy becomes much, much more compact as seen in each channel. Okay? And so making the galaxy more compact, of course, obviously helps a lot as we just saw. Okay? So if we imagine viewing our source galaxy in the 3D data cube, okay, where we have where we have frequency or velocity in the vertical axis. Then what happens is that the various components of that source galaxy show up separately across these different frequency channels. Okay, and then each of those separate components in the sources then get separately lensed by the foreground lens, producing therefore separate independent sets of arcs and rings. Okay, and each of those independent sets of arcs and rings provides independent constraints on the foreground mass distribution. All right. Okay. And so therefore, having ALMA observations of these sort of clumpy, turbulent galaxies, that's equivalent to having many, many independent point-like sources behind each lens. And that therefore gives us a much more accurate and a much more detailed reconstruction of the foreground mass distribution. Yeah? How do I know it's one galaxy? What do you mean? Right. This is spectral information, right? Yeah. This is frequency. Right. Yes, we're using the spectrum to break up the galaxy into multiple components, right? But the frequency difference between these different components is, of course, tiny compared to the typical velocities between galaxies, right? Oh, yeah, so if we have, separate galaxies making these clumps, all the better, right? Okay, yeah. No. So all that we care just is that these big blobs get broken up into small blobs. That's all that we care here. Yeah. Now, in general, of course, it's unusual to find two galaxies at the same location at the sky at the same, Hubble velocity relative to us, right? That correspond to them being on top of each other but still separate objects, okay? But for our purposes, of course, you know, none of that really matters. All that we care just is being able to increase our resolution of these objects relative to each other, either in terms of angle on the sky or also in terms of frequency. It's all that we care. Okay? So yeah, okay, you know, so the key point here just is that with these ALMA observations, we can get a much more detailed reconstruction of the mass distribution of the foreground lens. Okay, yeah, I know. And so much more detailed, of course, means that we are much more sensitive to things like small scale structure. Okay, so to estimate how well we can constrain this sort of low mass substructure with ALMA, what we did was to perform simulations of ALMA observations for these systems. Okay, so what we did was to simulate in total 1 hour integration time for ALMA cycle one in its most extended configuration. And I'll spare you maybe some of the gory observational details and just sort of jump to the main result of these simulations, which is here, I believe. Yes, okay, good. Okay, yeah, so this is the main result of our simulations. So what we found from our simulations is that at 5 sigma confidence, we can expect to find at least one, at least one detected subhalo for every single one of our high magnification lensing systems, okay, at 5 sigma confidence. Okay, now to remind you, so currently we have something like 50 of these, So we currently have 50 of these SPT lenses, and in total we expect something like 100 of these lenses in the full survey. Okay, and each one of them we expect to provide to us at least one detection of a substructure. Okay, and so therefore, really, really soon, on a very short time scale, we can therefore expect to dramatically improve our knowledge of the amount of this sort of small-scale structure that exists in the universe. Okay, as long as ALMA attacks are generous to us. Okay, so to remind you, so the existing constraints are based on a sample of 7 quasar lenses, right? From SPT, however, we'll have something like 100 of these SMG lenses, and so each of these SMG lenses, each one is equivalent to having many, many quasar lenses, okay? And so therefore, really, really soon, on a very short time scale, our constraints on dark matter substructure are poised to improve dramatically. Okay. So therefore, then, the next step, then, is to try to figure out how these sort of constraints on dark matter substructure will translate into constraints on cosmological parameters. Okay. So parameters like things like, for example, the temperature of warming, the temperature of dark matter, or, for example, the running of the spectral index. Now, surprisingly, however, it turns out that we currently don't know how to translate these observational measurements into constraints on cosmological parameters. Okay, so for various technical reasons, it turns out to be extremely difficult to perform n-body simulations of cosmologies where dark matter is not just perfectly cold, collisionless dark matter. Okay, and so currently we don't know how to translate these forthcoming ALMA constraints into constraints on cosmological parameters. But we are currently, fortunately, working on fixing that problem. Okay, and so one of my students is currently working on a very promising technique, to simulate cosmologies in which dark matter has a non-zero temperature. Okay, and so hopefully, pretty soon, it'll have results, which means that hopefully, pretty soon, this problem, so this problem will not be theory limited anymore. Okay. So hopefully, in the very near future, we'll be able to translate these amazing forthcoming measurements into actual constraints on cosmological parameters. Okay, things like warm dark matter, things like the running of the spectral index. So that's the main thing I wanted to say in this talk. Okay, so the main take-home message here in this talk just is that ALMA observations of these sort of lensed submillimeter galaxies. So in practice, this will be a fantastic probe of the small-scale structure of the universe. Okay, and so stay tuned, for the next couple of years as our results come out. Okay, and I'll stop there.
Thanks, I really enjoyed that. Could you go back to the final slide of your simulation? I just might have missed something. Okay, so you're saying you assume some model of what you think the substructure will be, and you're saying
I can detect. Yeah, exactly, okay, oh yeah, so right, yeah, so I should have mentioned that. Okay, yeah, I know. So to make this calculation, what we've done is to plug in the theoretically expected mass function of subhalos, okay? And then for each mass, we computed the cross section for detection, okay?
Okay, so it would just be nice to kind of have, given the theoretical uncertainty, to have kind of like a theory bound on that, right? Because there are various models for what we think the substructure should be, depending on your favorite. You know, there's theoretical
uncertainty. Right, yeah, that's right. So we only know this number for the standard cosmological model where we have a standard lambda CDM power spectrum, right?
I see.
So we don't know how to compute these numbers for variants of dark matter, for example. Right, okay.
That's fine. Yeah.
Yeah, right. But however, hopefully soon we will know that number.
Good. Okay, thanks.
Any other questions?
So you said there aren't,
Sorry?
What am I trying to say? So you were using this to look for the, to see if you could see the missing satellites, essentially.
Right.
But what about, like, you know, some other problems with substructure, something like too big to fail, where there's, like, missing heavier satellites?
I think that would be a way to... You will see those as well, right?
So you can use it to...
So we're mapping out the mass function of these low-mass structures as a function of mass. We'll just see all of those objects, especially those too big to fail objects. They're the easiest ones to see, right?
Okay.
Yeah.
And you also mentioned that you don't have, like, N-body simulations for warm dark matter. There are, like, a few on the market that people have done, but do you not believe that they've done them correctly?
This is public, I guess, eh? So there have been simulations that have a cutoff in the power spectrum. Those simulations are not capable of doing substructure. They can calculate the number of isolated halos, maybe. That is not warm dark matter. It's a cosmology with a cutoff in the power spectrum. Yeah.
Okay, if there's no other questions, let's thank Neil again.